Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Roddy Nickpour. Today we take you to the Claremont Hotel in Southwest Harbor for a talk by Steve Rapp. He's the chairman of the Commission for International Justice and Accountability at The Hague in the Netherlands. The title of today's talk is Fulfilling the Promise of Never Again, Arresting and Trying Perpetrators of Mass Atrocities. Rapp will take a look at the warning signs of atrocities such as the Holocaust, the Armenian Genocide, and others that are happening right now. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and this program will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Just click on radio to hear this program again at your convenience, and you'll find many other past Speaking in Maine programs. This program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing today's speaker is Bill McHugh, president of the Claremont Hotel.
Good evening, everyone. I'm delighted to see you all. It's a beautiful evening in Maine. And coming to a lecture of this seriousness and really significance for our time is not something that everyone does on a beautiful August evening in Maine, and I'm awfully glad that all of you did. And we welcome you all. As I think you know, this is our eighth lecture this summer in the annual summer Thursday evening lecture series at the Claremont, and really we're just delighted to have you here. I'm also really profoundly happy that Stephen J. Rapp, our speaker tonight, accepted my invitation to speak to us this evening and was able to make it work given that he's based in The Hague. In the last couple of hours, I've learned that Steve's schedule and his residence and the places that he works from are a great deal more complicated than that. So I guess what I would say is that I'm delighted that given his very complicated schedule, he was able to get here to Southwest Harbor, Maine this evening. Mr. Rapp has been for the past 17 years one of the world's principal prosecutors of the crimes of genocide and other crimes against humanity. Stephen J. Rapp is the current, I think, chairman of the Commission for International Justice and Accountability, which is at least theoretically based in The Hague. That's a long story that he may not want to relate, I'm not sure. In that role, and I believe that a transition has occurred in that role that, again, he can explain more than I can. But in that role, Ambassador Rapp led the effort to bring Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and his henchmen to justice for their myriad crimes of violence against the Syrian people. This, needless to say, was no small or trivial undertaking. Mr. Rapp is also the Global Prevention of Genocide Fellow at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum and the Father Drinan Visiting Professor of Human Rights at Georgetown Law School. Steve Rapp came to his life's work prosecuting international criminals the hard way by initially practicing law in Iowa. He then served in the Iowa House of Representatives, followed by his appointment as staff director and counsel for the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee. That position led to Steve's appointment as U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Iowa. In 2001, Steve joined the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. The tribunal was charged with prosecuting the instigators and perpetrators of the 1994 Rwandan genocide. Steve was not appointed the tribunal's chief prosecutor in 2005. In 2007, Mr. Rapp was named the chief prosecutor for Sierra Leone, in which role he prosecuted the infamous President Charles Taylor and his associates for their hideous crimes in the Sierra Leone Civil War. Prior to his work pursuing Bashar al-Assad, Steve Rapp served for six years as ambassador at large, leading the U.S. State Department's Office of Global Criminal Justice, pursuing the perpetrators of state-sponsored crimes. Steve can certainly tell you of his remarkable work, both its challenges and its accomplishments, much better than I can, so it's time for me to turn the floor over to him. Please welcome Steve Rapp to the Claremont.
Well, thank you very much, Bill, for that kind introduction. It's great to be here. This is the first time I've been in on Mont Desert Island and at the Claremont Hotel. And it's a wonderful event, and it's been beautiful being here today and walking down to the causeway and in the most beautiful time of the year. And I really thank Bill for including me in this lecture series. Of course, to talk about a very, very serious topic, which is this promise of never again, and how hard it has been to fulfill. And of course, we remember that the world did not respond to the warnings that preceded the Holocaust, the murder of 6 million European Jews and so many others during World War I or World War II, didn't hear the cry of the victims. And even when the credible reports came out of Eastern Europe, didn't effectively act to protect the victims of those crimes. And that led at least to a promise that we wouldn't let it happen again, that it would be never again. And we know from the history of the last 75 years that that's been a very hard promise to keep. And in so many places, it basically has not been kept. And tens of millions of people have been killed in other atrocities. And today we have 68.5 million refugees, both refugees across international borders and refugees within their own countries called internally displaced persons. And that's actually a record, the greatest number since World War II. And the reason those people are fleeing is not just because of conflict. Obviously, people get caught in the crossfire in conflict. But they're fleeing because they are the victims. They are the intended targets. And today, so often, we see situations where it's not the hard targets, not the combatants, not the force-on-force kind of conflicts that are occurring in our world, but it's actually men, women, and children, the intentional targets in crimes of terror and in actions taken, sad to say, by governments like that of Syria when they face demands for democracy in their own countries. As Bill said, I served as a U.S. attorney. I was a prosecutor in my home state for 8 years. I come to this largely from that experience, believing that if you do the crime, you should do the time, and that the perception that if crimes are committed, that people will face consequences is one of the ways. It's never perfect. And there is always criticism of how it's done, but when it's done properly in coordination, particularly with victims and the affected communities, it really is something that prevents crime in the future and makes our life something other than it would be, as Hobbes described it, in the state of nature: nasty, brutish, and short. But in many places in the world, that is indeed the case. It's nasty, brutish, and short because of the crimes committed by powerful individuals. So a key part of this is accountability, and that's the perception. Perhaps because of the case that was prosecuted next door or last week in a neighborhood or in an area, and because of the message that's sent by that case, perpetrators think twice about attacking the innocent. Sadly, in the case of mass atrocities, and certainly in many of the conflict zones that we have today, perpetrators think they can get away with it. And I'm reminded, as we talk about the Holocaust, of what Hitler said at Berchtesgaden when he met his general staff in late August of 1939, after they'd signed the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, and after he was prepared to invade Poland. He said, you know, you need to act with maximum brutality. Who now remembers the Armenians? Indeed, there had been no justice after the genocide of the Armenians in eastern Turkey. More than 1 million people killed, the whole community of Armenians in eastern Turkey basically eliminated. And the absence of justice, substantial justice, there were several trials, even those verdicts have been ignored, but the absence of real justice has led even the United States and other governments to avoid confronting the denial of that crime by successive Turkish governments, including the current Erdogan government. This work of accountability never ends, as it never ends for police and courts and prosecutors and in any civilized society. And I'm bringing this up only because we had a reminder of it just this week. As long as there are perpetrators of these crimes among us, it's necessary to take action. And we even still have actions based on World War II. Now, in the U.S., our ability to take actions even about Nazis who were involved in the Holocaust, who were present in the United States, who came in pretending that they were victims instead of victimizers, has been difficult because until the 1980s, our laws did not permit us to actually prosecute those crimes. And when we changed the laws, it only was for crimes committed after the 1980s. So the approach in the U.S., particularly became aggressive in the 1980s and 90s, and certainly when I was working in the State Department for 6 years, continued that efforts, was when we found people that had been involved in the Holocaust who were present in the United States. Our action was to engage in litigation, to strip those persons of asylum or legal entry into the United States because of the false statements they'd made on entry, and to strip them of citizenship because of the false statements that they'd made on citizenship. And typically, you would certify, "I've never committed human rights violations, I've never committed genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity." We were able to do that. But then even when we did that, the question is what to do next. And our approach was to send them back to a country that would take them, ideally that would prosecute them. And that was possible eventually with Germany to take them back if they were Germans. But if they weren't Germans and they committed the crimes for Germany, but they weren't German citizens, the Germans wouldn't take them back. And then the other countries that they came from wouldn't take them back either for a variety of reasons. Now, in Germany, that finally changed about 6 years ago, because until about 6 years ago, before we could send a Nazi back to Germany, we actually had to say, this person killed somebody in this concentration camp on this date, and here's the evidence, and here's the bullet, and here's all the evidence, even though, of course, they were involved in crimes that involved tens and hundreds of thousands of victims. Anyway, as you probably saw, we had a development this week, and it was in a case, and this was only a small part of my portfolio when I was in the State Department, but I had pressed it in Warsaw in Berlin. I'd gone to the German War Crimes Unit in Ludwigsburg, south of Stuttgart, and pressed the case of Jacob Pauli, who'd been part of Operation Reinhardt, that killed hundreds of thousands of Jews in the death camps of eastern Poland. And he had, until Tuesday, been living comfortably among Holocaust survivors in Queens. On Tuesday, he was sent back to Germany. Normally, my focus in this work of prosecution is the high-level actors. But for people who participate in these horrendous crimes against the innocent, there really needs to be no rest in this life. But my own experience, as Bill said, was in 2001. I left from the position that I held in Iowa and went to the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, and then later went to the International Hybrid Court that was established for Sierra Leone. And the one for Rwanda is the one that I wanted to talk about specifically, because it is such a profound crime, and it was such an experience of a kind, I think, that has great lessons to us. The Rwanda genocide started 25 years ago this coming April. And I don't think those developments were followed very closely in the U.S. They weren't followed in my home state of Iowa. I had just become the U.S. attorney in northern Iowa beginning in November of 1993, 6 months into the job. My wife, Dolly, teaches African history at the University of Northern Iowa, follows what's happening in Africa all the time, so we would listen in that era when it wasn't on internet to the BBC on shortwave and certainly follow the news that occurred on April 6, 1994 when the Rwandan's president's plane was shot down on its approach to the Kigali airport. And hearing that, knowing what we did about Rwanda, we were extremely worried. And indeed, within hours, the mass killing started. It was unleashed according to a plan that had been described, indeed, by an informant, to General Dallaire, who a French-Canadian from not far from here, who was the UN force commander. He had an informant that 3 months earlier had told him that a plan is in place. At the time of the next crisis, we will begin the killing of the Tutsi minority. And lists have been drawn, groups have been dispatched, machetes and other weapons are available, and a Tutsi indeed will be killed, not just one, but 1,000 every 20 minutes in their homes. It began that night. When they fled their homes, they went to roadblocks. Indeed, as I discovered later, roadblocks were put out approximately every 150 yards on the main roads. If they weren't killed at the roadblocks, and they managed to get to places where they thought they'd be safe, to churches, to schools, the international aid missions, they'd be killed there. Even at the nation's borders, they were murdered, as this was not a campaign of ethnic cleansing. And indeed, that had happened before in Rwanda, when they decided that they would drive the Tutsi minority out of the country by killing some in order to get others to flee. But indeed, at the border, they killed them because, as the propagandists described it, the only Tutsis left should be those in the history books. In just 100 days, 800,000 men, women, and children were slaughtered. It's like three World Trade Centers a day in a country a third the size of Maine for 100 days. Not a spasm of intertribal violence, which is what we often heard in the press. Tribal violence breaks out between these ethnic groups. It was a planned genocide. It's logistically supported, executed, and expanded to cover every hill and commune, organized by political and military leaders, with the aid of others from the media, the business, and religion, all to preserve the power and privileged positions. Frankly, not a whole lot different than when we talk about the Holocaust and the Wannsee Conference with General Heydrich arriving at the lake resort on the southwest corner of Berlin to basically involve everyone in the decision in January of 1942 to implement the final solution of the Jewish people. It was that crime that drew me to go to international justice. In Iowa, I had, the worst case I ever had 5 people murdered. It took us 8 years to dig up the bodies and find the perpetrators, and we pursued that case. But in May of 2001, I resigned as U.S. attorney in Northern Iowa, and 4 days later arrived in Tanzania, which is not Arusha, which is not Rwanda, but it's the country next over from Rwanda, and was hired as the position of senior trial attorney of the International Criminal Tribunal that had been established by the UN to try those responsible for the Rwanda genocide. And I was put in charge of the media trial Media trial, what's a media trial about? A media trial was about the fact that a key part of the genocide was the incitement to it. We talk about hate speech. We talk about the kind of messages that sometimes are delivered even now in the social media. But that was an absolutely essential part of the genocide. The genocide occurred in every town that was under the control of the interim government. And it was implemented by people that weren't particularly pro-interim government. But it was was implemented because the messages came down from on high from the media. These are the enemy. These are the people that you need to take out. Even to the point of sometimes describing individual victims and license numbers and everything else. When I arrived, the media trial was in its seventh month. It involved two people who'd been essentially the directors of this radio station that had been established, RTLM as it was called, and also the editor of a newspaper that had encouraged members of Rwanda's Hutu majority to see the Tutsi minority as their eternal enemy. Arrived in May of 2001, the trial, and we can talk about trials at the international level, challenging, took another 27 months, a total of 243 days in court. And I must say, having done a lot of these cases, proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the messages delivered on the radio, which weren't delivered in English, they weren't delivered in French, they were delivered in the native Rwandan language of Kinyarwanda, often in proverbs that were only fully understood in that culture, were crafted to cause mass murder, and that these guys actually were responsible for that, was the most challenging task that my teammates and I had ever faced. 4 months after we concluded the trial in August of 2003, the three-judge trial chamber returned a unanimous judgment, the first convictions in history for direct and public incitement to genocide through the mass media. After that, I moved on in the Rwanda Tribunal and was promoted to be in charge of all of the trial teams, the 12 trial teams that were pursuing the military and the political and the religious leaders. We had priests, we had bishops, we had others that were implicated in the genocide. At the end of 2006, as Bill said, I went over to Sierra Leone. I was appointed by the UN Secretary General to be the chief prosecutor of the Special Court for Sierra Leone. Different kind of court than the court for Rwanda. It was established in a partnership between the UN and the government, and it pursued those responsible for the mass atrocities that occurred in that West African country between 96 and 2000. Which included, most famously, if you've seen the movie Blood Diamond with Leonardo DiCaprio, they amputated thousands of hands and arms, with the rebels cynically asking, do you want short sleeves or long sleeves, in terms of where they would be chopping off the hands, but also mass killing of tens of thousands, and sexual violence and forced marriage and sexual slavery of, frankly, hundreds of thousands of women. Most significantly in that court, we prosecuted President Taylor from Liberia next door, who had, in our view, was an essential element to assisting and essentially running the rebels that were committing these crimes. After that, I came back to the U.S. and was appointed ambassador at large. And when Bill talks about travel and trying to figure out where I am, it is still a situation that this at large idea was something that actually I kind of enjoy. But what's an ambassador at large? And we have ambassador to countries. And when I told my wife I was going to be an ambassador, she said, we get a big house, you know, get to invite our friends to come out. And I said, no, this is at large. I said, I'll get a little office in Washington, but then I get to rove everywhere in the world. And so when you think at large, think like fugitives at large, always on the run. because of the law. So, but anyway, for 6 years, I traveled 220 days a year, 1,100 flights, including 20 African airlines, most of which have since crashed or gone broke since then, 1.5 million miles, 87 countries, 15 times to the Congo, et cetera, not to the garden spots. But basically trying to work the same kind of program. Basically trying to develop courts that could investigate the crimes, could find out who really did it, who were the big shots that made it happen, and try them fairly. Not lock them up because we didn't like them. They were politically opposed to us, but a system of fair trials. Not easy. And obviously the preference was always to try to do it at the national level if we could, but otherwise it was to try to build and staff and to fund international or partnership kind of courts where justice would be possible. And then once that happened, to try to fund those courts and to help them make their arrests and help protect the witnesses and what it's all about, which is what you need to do if you really are serious about saying that we don't want the innocent murdered based upon their ethnicity, on their religion, on being in the way of people who see their deaths as key to their position or power. As Bill said, I've continued. I left the State Department 3 years ago this month, received funding from the U.S. Holocaust Museum, a fantastic institution. I hope you've visited in Washington. It has a Center for the Prevention of Genocide. It provides assistance to me, travel, and a small stipend to continue to be involved in these efforts. A key part of it is what Bill described as this Commission for International Justice and Accountability, which is actually a private NGO supported by governments that works to document these crimes and develop the solid evidence of them while they're being committed. But it also involves always working with the victims, with the survivors, and trying to help them find relief for their own suffering. But as they will always tell you, a key part of that is holding the perpetrators to account. Getting that done is always a matter of trying to persuade even our own government now or other countries to support trials and arrests of mass killers, even if they need to do it by creating international or mixed courts. And again, it's all part of this idea that if we can create the real possibility that individual perpetrators will face justice, they will think twice before they give or follow an order, an illegal order. And it's what we need to fulfill that pledge of never again.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Steve Rapp works with The Hague in the Netherlands to bring war criminals to justice. He's recalling some of those cases from his career, and he's considering how they can be prevented moving forward.
Interestingly, because of the topic, and I'm after the event here, I will head to Buffalo, and will this later this weekend be in Jamestown in Chautauqua, New York. Jamestown is the hometown of Robert Jackson, who's one of the greatest U.S. Supreme Court justices, who served from 1941 to 1954. The most intriguing thing that he did was he was asked by Truman, a few days after Roosevelt's death, to lead an effort to hold the Nazi leaders to account. And so we hold this for the last 11 years. We held reunions of international prosecutors, myself and others who have done the work in Rwanda and Yugoslavia and Cambodia and Sierra Leone and elsewhere, with the survivors still from Nuremberg. We had several of them when we started this in 2007. Now we have only one, my good friend Ben Ferenz, who's now 98, who you might have seen in 60 Minutes a few weeks ago. He's the last survivor of at Nuremberg. He'd been at D-Day. He's an interesting guy. Graduated from Harvard on a scholarship. Grew up in Transylvania. Managed to get out of Romania. At 23, graduated from Harvard Law School, but then was drafted and was at D-Day, and then with Patton into Germany. But because he had written a memo on war crimes when he was in law school, he was assigned to investigate cases of Nazis who had organized the lynchings of captive Allied airmen. And after doing a number of those cases, which always involved trying to figure out who did it and digging up the corpse in the cities and these areas in Germany in May, June, July of 1945, he was called to Nuremberg to work with Justice Jackson, who, as I said, had been appointed to lead the prosecution of the Nazi leaders. And I mean, I can talk about Jackson and that effort, but eventually, by November, they launched the trials against the 22 surviving Nazi leaders led by Hermann Göring in a trial that was organized by the four great victorious powers. And Jackson, in my view, gave the greatest speeches ever given in a courtroom and spoke of that trial of the Nazi leaders. Many, like Churchill, said to shoot them. But he says that we need to hold them guilty in fair trials according to, frankly, their own records and documents, and said that trial, as he said in his opening address, was the greatest tribute that power had ever paid to reason. And I love his speech, and I'm always looking for quotes from it. But my favorite, because I believe in prosecuting the big shots, it was in the second minute of his address, in which he said that the common sense of man, the common sense of mankind requires that the law should not stop with the punishment of little people for petty crimes. It must reach men who possess themselves of great power and make deliberate and concerted use of that power to set in motion evils which touch every home. Eventually, in that great trial of the 22 Nazis, 18 were convicted, 3 were acquitted. Jackson went back to the Supreme Court. General Taylor, who was his deputy, asked Ben Ferenz to stay on, to lead 12 subsequent trials at Nuremberg that frankly don't get much attention in American history. But they were trials entirely with American personnel, with judges. You know, I mean, I'm sure you saw, I don't know how many people saw judgment at Nuremberg. What state did Spencer Tracy come from? He was a state court judge defeated in the state of Maine. and called to Nuremberg to prosecute to be a judge in one of the subsequent trials. I don't know if that was fictional. But the trial wasn't fictional. The trial was of the judges. The judges tried the judges, the Nazi judges. Remember that great scene at the end when the judge has been convicted, wants to talk to Spencer Tracy and said, "I didn't mean any of this to happen, Your Honor. I never knew that it would lead to this. You must understand, your judgment is entirely fair." And Spencer Tracy looks at him and says, "You knew it would happen the first time you sent an innocent man to his death." So anyway, that was a wonderful one. One at least, Maximilian Schell and Judy Garland Oscars in 1960. But in any case, that was one of the subsequent trials. There were also of the industrialists, of the doctors. Ben, he was a junior guy, and He's about 4'8". He's no shorter, taller than he was in 1947. But he was supporting the other trials, and he heard that that they had found the records of the Einsatzgruppen near Tempelhof Airport. And so he flew from Nuremberg to Berlin, and indeed there were a lot of records of the Einsatzgruppen. If you know the Einsatzgruppen, which means operation group, but it was the group of SS, all led by very professional, very highly educated officers who went into Russia after the Wehrmacht in June of 1941 in order to kill the Jews and the other minorities behind the lines. And they had meticulous records. And Ben there went with an old adding machine, and he started adding up the reports of the murders. And you've seen some, there are a few images that survive from Nazi documentaries of people being shot, often naked and tumbled into ditches. And he added up and added up and added up and added up. And when he got to 1 million murdered. And this is not the gas chambers, this is bullets. He went to Telford Taylor and said, "We need to prosecute the leaders here." And Taylor said, "No. We have too many trials, too much time, take too much time." Ben said, "I'll do it myself. I've got the documents. I can put on the case in 2 days. Taylor said, "Go ahead." So he prosecuted the Einsatzgruppen case, as he always talks about, the greatest murder trial in history in terms of having 1 million specific victims. And in his opening address, given 70 years ago last September, he used the term from Raphael Lemkin that wasn't in the statute, but that Lemkin, a Polish academic, had invented to describe the crime of the Nazis, the term genocide, for the first time. And Ben was largely successful in that prosecution. I mean, I tend to be inspired, as you might imagine, by those things. Now, obviously, what we're facing today is much more challenging. Crimes that are committed in Syria with 500,000 dead, very close to a Syrian military photographer that I helped get out of the country, who brought us 50,000 pictures of people tortured to death in Assad's prisons. That kind of evidence, the use of chemical weapons, the use of barrel bombs, the attacks on hospitals, the attacks on doctors, are crimes. It's not the Holocaust. On the other hand, even World War II, we didn't attack hospitals and doctors and ambulances. And we didn't use poison gas in combat. And so horrendous crimes are being committed in our world. And we don't have a court established like the Yugoslavian Rwanda courts were by the UN Security Council, because the Russians would veto any effort to do that, or to send it to the International Criminal Court, of which the United States is not a party, but which can take cases if a Security Council votes to send them there, and if there's no veto. And when that happened in 2014. When that resolution came forth, it had 13 of 15 members voting for it. The U.S. supported it. Russia and China voted no. It was a veto. It didn't happen. And so in that kind of conflict, we go to South Sudan, where 4 million have been displaced, at least 50,000 killed on what is really is close to an ethnic genocide, basically fought by leaders who think killing the ethnic group that's associated with the other side is the way they succeed. There are ways maybe to have justice, but it's not going to happen through an international tribunal. In Myanmar, or Burma as we call it, we had 700,000 Rohingya Muslims pushed out of Western Burma through mass ethnic cleansing, as we call it, but that basically means murder, rape, burning, to such an extreme extent that within 3 weeks, 700,000 people crossed into Bangladesh into squalid and difficult conditions, because otherwise they were dead. That's also a situation where China would oppose any kind of international justice. So that's the kind of challenges that keep me on the road these days with groups like CEJA, which basically involves what's the first step? The evidence, the accounts, the documents. My friends in CEJA now have 750,000, I mean, chair of it, I mean, but the organization of which I'm the chair of has 750,000 pages of internal documents from Assad, with his orders, with his names, with the declarations, et cetera, all with the seals of the Syrian Arab Republic. And we're developing that evidence in other places, and then in the absence of international justice, trying to find ways to try people in third countries. A little like we were doing with Pali in the United States, though in many countries it's possible to try people for their actual crimes. And we recently got an arrest warrant in Germany for the Assad's head of Air Force Intelligence, where the worst torture has occurred. I mean, they bomb and use poison gas, but they also run the worst detention centers, where tens of thousands of people have been tortured to death. And General Jassim Hassan has been indicted by Germany. We will seek indictments of others through whatever jurisdiction that can be found. All of this is a part of the idea that even when states may not support it, we need to continue the work of justice, because these crimes don't happen because of spontaneous combustion. They're not crazy people who do these crimes. They're not evil people, evil in the sense that the devil woke up one day and decided he was going to kill all of humankind. No, they're calculated people who decide they want to do these crimes for their own ends, in the same way that people steal money, engage in organized criminal activity in developed countries. And we need to change the equation and do whatever we can to give people the perception that if they do the crime, they may have to do the time. That's, in the end, what protects the weak and from those who would brutally take the lives of a property of the innocent, its consequences. So it's all a matter of trying to build on the legacy. It's a challenge. It's challenging work. Obviously built at Nuremberg, but particularly thereafter, with these courts that I worked with in Rwanda and Sierra Leone. I haven't talked a great deal about Yugoslavia and some of the other places, but it fundamentally is a matter of justice, and that's what I continue to work on, and to ensure that the kind of crimes that we have seen certainly in the last century, and we're seeing again in the second decade of this century, don't recur in the future. And certainly, if we don't. You know, I see things like Syria, where norms, that, as I said, that had even been enforced in the 20th century are being thrown out the window. When we later in this world, affected by whatever crisis, whatever global warming, whatever overpopulation, whatever movements of people, when we face conflicts that will break out, if the norms that we haven't established and put efforts behind enforcing aren't enforced, then nobody in the next generations will be safe anywhere in the world. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Steve Rapp will now answer questions from the audience.
So what can be done to enforce these decisions? Once you condemn Assad, well, he's still here. So what significance, what is the actual benefit of these decisions?
Thank you. And I hope people heard that. I mean, what's the benefit of decisions if you succeed? Now, do keep in mind that when it came to Milosevic, the president of Yugoslavia, when it came to Charles Taylor, who from Liberia, when it comes to President Gbagbo from Cote d'Ivoire, those people are in trial and have been been arrested by courts and will be held to account. And so when they're found guilty, they'll spend a good long time in prison. If they're not, if the evidence isn't there, they'll be released. Okay. Now, but do keep in mind that when we do cases at the international level, it wasn't always that easy. When Mladic and Karadzic, if you know the case, Karadzic was the political leader of the Bosnian Serb breakaway republic. Mladic was the commander of Bosnian Serb forces. Most famously, they're allegedly and have been now found guilty of the murder of 8,000 Muslim men and boys at Srebrenica and massive crimes against the civilians, the Muslim civilians and Croat civilians in the former Yugoslavia. They were on the run they were indicted by my friend Richard Goldstone at the Yugoslavia Tribunal in 95. Karadzic was arrested in 2008, 13 years later. After that, nobody thought we'd ever get Mladic. And the United States brought intense pressure on Serbia. The Dutch government and the European Union let it be known that Serbia couldn't join the EU, which at least at that point was viewed as something that would double its national income, unless it fully enforced the order. Our intelligence communities, both Britain and the United States, worked closely with then the Serbian government to locate him. And on the 26th of May, 2011, he was arrested, 16 years after having his name on a wanted poster. So it can sometimes take a very long time. And as I said, even though it's not necessarily a criminal case, our friend Mr. Polly was implicated in the Trebniki death camp and labor camp in Poland in 1943 and 1944. And last Tuesday, he was sent to Germany, potentially to face trial, 75 years after his crime. So it's no certain that you're going to get justice right away. On the other hand, when I was U.S. attorney in Northern Iowa, I tried one murder case, charged a guy who left the country. He still hasn't been found. That was in 1997. So you're never sure that you're going to get them. Do keep in mind that when you do these third country cases, it is more complicated. When you have an international court, if it's been established by the UN Security Council, then every state's supposed to comply. If a third country, now how did this case in Germany arise? Germany has universal jurisdiction. It's accepted hundreds of thousands of Syrians. It has tens of thousands that went through the crimes. They provided evidence. They have asserted their jurisdiction over these crimes. And they have, based on the evidence, like the Caesar photos, the defector that I discussed, developed this case. And so they put out an international arrest warrant against a guy who is at El Meza Air Force Base in southern Damascus. Was he going to Germany anytime soon? Well, he sees an arrest warrant. He may not be. On the other hand, he is on an international arrest warrant that has been sent out by Interpol to 192 countries. He's, maybe he'll just stay in Syria for the rest of his life. Maybe he won't visit the family members. Maybe he won't visit the money he stole. Et cetera. Maybe he'll never do that. Okay, well, we've done something, haven't we? So as I say, there is that aspect of it. And is that, now, of course, we can name and shame them. We can put a sanction on them. We do that already. That's not quite the same as proof, trials, judgments, all of that. And certainly in terms of getting, collared and sent to jail, it's a different thing. Now, but it's not, when I deal with my Syrian victims, it's pretty small stuff. It's not what we did with Milosevic. It's not what we did with the Rwandan genocide heirs. So it's less, and why not? Because we've obviously got the Russians backing them up. And so we can't get international action. We have to go to individual states. But the question is, do we just ignore it? We just, what the heck? Won the war? Murdered his way out of it? Reconstruct him with international aid? You know, make everybody go home and then have half the rest of their family taken into jail? Is that the answer? Does that protect anybody in the future? No, that sends the future, the message to the future. Do the same thing. So, as I say, I mean, these are not, it's not like, you know, the kind of drug conspiracy cases on methamphetamine I did in Northern Iowa, you know, where I managed to get a lot of the guides, you know. But I mean, this is something that I think is serious and is the way that I know to make it, to create the perception that there are consequences. That's not to say, keep in mind, I mean, people say, well, what, how, I mean, there are a lot of other complex issues and you didn't ask them, will the guy make a peace agreement if he's gonna be arrested? There are a lot of other issues that people deal with, but fundamentally, you say if you commit crimes that are so serious, we're not gonna sweep them under the rug.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for the service that you're giving in such a worthy cause. My question is, in the case of Assad, do you think that it would be something that could be pursued to also indict Putin in regards to the atrocities, in that he could be considered as an aider and abettor?
Well, very good question. And from a legal standpoint, the answer, I think, is yes, that one could make that kind of case. The question is, in what country's court could you do that? Generally, when you go to third countries, there's a general rule you don't prosecute leaders who are currently in power. You just prosecute their lieutenants. Contrary to the rule in international courts, if you have an international tribunal, then you can prosecute Milosevic or Taylor or people like that. And so it would be challenging to go after a guy at that level, and politically it would be difficult to get the support for it. I mean, keep in mind the Russians didn't want Milosevic arrested. They didn't want Mladic arrested. Eventually they became in some ways more extreme than the Serbs when it came to the crimes of the former Yugoslavia, and they continued to in their own way, you know, like we've seen in terms of Russian propaganda, to exacerbate Serb, Croatian, Bosnian hatred in the former Yugoslavia. So they're very much part of that effort. But and we got the court established because Yeltsin was then in. If Putin had been in when we established that court, it wouldn't have gotten through the Security Council. So that was then. This is now. So there is that aspect. Things internationally were better in the 90s than they are now. That said, we were able to maintain the pressure into this decade and get it done. Why? Because, you know, who wants to move to Moscow, huh? I mean, you know, when you really get down to it, what do people look at? I mean, it's what, you know, they want to move west. They want to develop in that direction. And so we can continue to play the assets that we have. It's not just economic, it's in terms of our values, the things we believe in, the things we fight for. So I don't think we're completely, you know, hopeless in these efforts. One of the issues that's going to come up squarely in the very near future on Putin is MH17. If you may remember, in July 2014, a civilian passenger jet flying from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur shot down over the eastern Ukraine. Now, with all due respect to people, I'm a prosecutor, I never want to overstate my case. I don't think they wanted to kill 300 civilians, including 200 German tourists, or 200 Dutch tourists, but they did. They violated civilian avionics law, aeronautics law, et cetera. It's a crime. The Dutch came to the UN and said, we want a tribunal. to try this. And the Russians, Putin said, I'll veto that. We didn't do it, you know. But of course, they did. They provided the weapon. They took it over the border, working with the separatists that are frankly dressed in, you know, redressed in the local uniforms, et cetera, engaged in this effort to basically take over eastern Ukraine after, you know, Manafort's friend was overthrown, you know, et cetera. And they engaged in that effort. And so, and they were clearly responsible for these crimes. And the Dutch formed a joint investigative team with the Belgians, the Ukrainians, the Malaysians, and the Australians, plane and victims and territory, and basically have laid it all out. So they're going to start charging people. But now, will they charge Russians? Will they try? Will they charge others? And so, you know, you don't expect the Russians will continue, you know, like killing this person, trying to kill a spy and his daughter in Salisbury, England, and then because the chemicals were left behind, they ended up killing a poor woman who was in a rehab center, et cetera. I mean, these kind of acts of horrendous murder, they'll continue to say, it's a lie, it's fake news, et cetera. But the point is that, you know, we need to use the pressures that we have. We need to grab assets, grab banks, deal with the Russian plutocrats that are living in London. I mean, there are a variety of ways that we can get at this if we're serious. Of course, Russians are doing more than that. They've already partially implemented their plan on the 2018 elections here, et cetera. So, I mean, there's a lot of things that are going on, and the answer to it is serious investigation and response. Okay, thank you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today we heard from Steve Rapp, a distinguished fellow at The Hague in the Netherlands. He recently joined us at the Claremont Hotel in Southwest Harbor for a talk on arresting and trying perpetrators of mass atrocities. If you missed part of the program or you want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Just click radio to find this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Roddy Nickpour. Thanks for joining us.